Cleary.
Thank you, Your Honor. Terry Sawyer was charged with being part of a conspiracy to deal in methamphetamine. Prior to trial, I informed the government that Ms. Sawyer intended to pursue a defense of coercion or duress. Evidence about threats to Sawyer was not a mere afterthought at the trial, but was somewhat pervasive throughout. Government witnesses corroborated the relationship between Sefi Rodriguez and Sawyer's then-boyfriend Ryan that gave rise to this series of events. Independent witnesses such as Brad Polster, Donnie Sherman, and Brian Rourke corroborated Sawyer's accounts. Sawyer herself testified in her own defense about what she did, why she did it, and why she felt she could not go to the police. This is set forth in some detail in the brief and the facts and arguments, but in a nutshell, Rodriguez and Ryan Beauchamp were friends and drug dealers at the time that Sawyer began a relationship with Ryan. There was at least two drug deals in which Ryan ripped off Rodriguez. There was a time when Rodriguez and several other men of Mexican descent came to the house that Terry shared with Ryan and her son. This was witnessed by others. There was another time when Rodriguez and some other men came and forced Ms. Sawyer to go try to get Ryan's boat as sort of a ransom for these drug debts. Ms. Sawyer testified that this, you know, she felt a constant fear from Rodriguez, and that she had to try to get customers for him to sell meth to sort of work off this debt, and that she did not go to the police because she was in fear of her life because of Rodriguez's connections with the Mexican mafia, which he had told her about. Ultimately, the district court gutted Sawyer's defense by refusing her tenured instruction on duress. The focus here...
I'm interested in your analysis of the Supreme Court's opinion in Bailey, because Bailey made a similar argument that if he had stayed in prison or reported to the police immediately after his escape, he would have been beaten up. The Supreme Court said it was insufficient as a matter of law. I'm trying to figure out why Bailey isn't dispositive here.
Well, Your Honor, I'm... with all due respect, I'm not familiar with Bailey, but I would...
Bailey is the Supreme Court's only decision on this subject. It's cited in the government's brief.
Well,
I expected you to read Supreme Court decisions cited by the prosecutor.
Your Honor, I was focused on these other cases. Your Honor, I would argue it's not dispositive because, as in Dixon, which is another case on the U.S. Supreme Court case on duress instructions, in Dixon, the court notes that duress is a common law defense, that and the defendant needs to show some immediate fear, but the defense doesn't need to be proven by a preponderance. The defendant must show some foundation in order to get the instruction. That's our argument here, that Ms. Sawyer had shown that foundation. In the court's description of Bailey, it sounds like what you're talking about a future threat, okay, which is why, in a sense, Judge McKinney appeared to deny the instruction here that Ms. Sawyer had failed to show it was an immediate threat. Duress, the right to present a defense is fundamental. It's a key component of a defendant's right to trial. This court has held that a defendant is entitled to a duress instruction if she can establish an immediate threat of death or serious bodily injury, that there's a well-grounded fear that this would be carried out, and there's no reasonable opportunity to avoid the harm. As an affirmative defense, the burden would have been on Ms. Sawyer to prove this by a preponderance, which appeared to be the standard that Judge McKinney used in denying the instruction. We feel that's incorrect, that the defendant would be entitled to the instruction if she's shown some foundation of this, even if that foundation may be weak, or the evidence insufficient or of doubtful credibility, as this court has held. We believe that she met that standard through the testimony of her and her witnesses, and that the defendant, is entitled to an instruction on theory of defense if the defendant proposes a correct statement of law, which we did, tendered the Seventh Circuit proposed instruction. If that's supported by the evidence, which in this case we feel it was, that the defense theory is not part of the charge, and that the failure to instruct would deny the defendant a fair trial.
She had lots of opportunities to separate herself from this and tell the police, especially at the end of it. I think she was a number of months somewhere else, wasn't she?
There was certainly a long gap in time between the start of this case, between the start of the conspiracy and when she was arrested. There was a gap in time when Mr. Rodriguez absented himself from Indiana and went to Texas. I think the record would show that there were pretty daily phone calls or between Rodriguez and Sawyer when he was in town, but I think the record would reflect that there was certainly time to do that. Her testimony was that she did not do so because of her fear that if she went to the police, that would become known and she would be harmed.
If that's true with every criminal, you know, if they separate themselves or whatever, if they tell on them, they'll say, well, their friends will get you and that sort of thing. I think that's just the nature of the unfortunate condition of being in a kind of a conspiracy. If we had a rule like that, then everybody's under duress.
Well, and I guess the difference, Judge, would be in this case we had, you know, specific instances of people coming to our house, witnessed by other people.
Widely separated in time.
They're separated in time, there's no doubt about that. But I guess the question, going back to what you said about this would be in every case, I don't think in every case you would have this, what Sawyer had, of people coming to her house, of being forced to go and get this boat, and having independent corroboration of all that. It's not just her testimony. So unless the court has other questions, we would ask that the conviction in this case be reversed and remanded for a new trial.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Cleary. Mr. Blackington.
Thank you. May it please the court, I think where the court was going in the questioning of Mr. Cleary, as well as the citation of Bailey, goes to show fundamentally, more than anything else, how difficult it is to establish yourself in instruction, the entitlement to a duress instruction, where you have an ongoing crime like conspiracy, particularly where this crime was ongoing for more than a year. There are two elements of the duress instruction that a defendant has to prove to get the instruction. The first is that the defendant reasonably feared immediate death or serious bodily injury. Secondly, that the defendant could only avoid immediate death or harm by committing the crime. There's also another statement that this court has made in the context of addressing duress instructions, and that is that after the duress loses its coercive force, and this is the heart of the Bailey opinion, after duress loses its coercive force, the defendant has to immediately cease committing the offense.
Not simply has to cease committing the offense, has to report to the police that the offense has been committed.
To entitle himself, yeah, to a duress instruction. Now, the defendant hasn't...
I think that Sawyer doesn't argue that she ever went to the police and said, I've been committing this offense.
No, and maybe in Ms. Sawyer's behalf, there's a line between withdrawal from a conspiracy where you have to report to the authorities that you've committed the offense to withdraw and entitlement to duress. I don't know if I found a case, and maybe the court has, where the Supreme Court or the Seventh Circuit says, to entitle yourself to a duress instruction, you have to report the offense to the police.
Bailey held that.
But you at least have to get out. Well, in Bailey, the defendant must proffer evidence of a bona fide effort to surrender or return to custody as soon as the claimed duress or necessity has lost its coercive force. And, you know, I'm not sure if the, that's, you know, an escape offense to terminate your involvement in a crime. You have to go back to the authorities and surrender yourself by nature of the crime of escape. But in any event, she didn't do either.
Well, I assume that would have to be sometime when she's arrested, she's under that she's currently under duress. That's what you would have to claim, as opposed to something that happened 6 months ago.
I didn't follow the question.
When you don't have to go to the police, you don't go to the police if somebody's got a gun on you, or you got you, you might say, imprisoned or something, where you're absolutely confined and you can't do it, and then they arrest everybody, and she says, I'm under duress.
Yeah, that doesn't matter.
I assume that's when they would raise that defense.
Yeah, and she didn't even do that here.
No, that's because she wasn't that way.
The defendant didn't show an immediate death or serious bodily injury. I cited, and excuse me if I butcher the pronunciation of the case, the Sahakian case, where a prisoner had heard that there was a price on his head, so he possessed a weapon and alleged that alleged duress for why he possessed a weapon in jail. And this court in Sahakian distinguished between an immediate threat and a threat of future violence at an unspecified time. And that's really what Terry Sawyer had in this case. And I cited in my brief some examples of her testimony where she was saying that, well, the Seferino Rodriguez told me that at some point in the future the Mexican mafia would hurt me. That's not the immediate threat that the Sahakian case was talking about. And in Sahakian, this court said that Sahakian lost because the person making the supposed threat against him, that they did not allege that the person making the threat was standing in front of him with a knife or other weapon at the time he informed Sahakian that he would like to see him dead. And that's why in the context of these ongoing crimes like conspiracy, duress just doesn't work, because there is no evidence that Terry Sawyer presented here that during this year or more of methamphetamine dealing, someone was standing over her, threatening her with immediate harm or death if she didn't supply the methamphetamine. There were just these vague threats of something that might happen in the future. Secondly, Terry Sawyer didn't show that she could avoid immediate harm only by committing the offense. She never contacted the police. And the Tanner case I cited, which was a contraband case, a prisoner in jail with cocaine, said that he had the cocaine because other prisoners had threatened his life. This court rejected the duress, or upheld the district court's decision to not issue the duress instruction in that case because the prisoner had never asked for protective custody. And then finally, of course, Terry Sawyer has to cease committing the offense once the duress loses its coercive force. She moved to Richmond, Indiana in January of 2006. When the police went into her house, I believe in October or November of 2006, she had more methamphetamine in the house. And 9 months after she moved to Richmond, Heather Crowder placed a consensually recorded telephone call to her in which she agreed to supply Crowder with methamphetamine. So in this case, she just didn't present enough evidence to satisfy any of the prongs required for the duress instruction. There are three other arguments raised in Ms. Sawyer's brief that I feel the briefs cover very thoroughly, and apparently my opposing counsel does as well, because he didn't argue them. I think that the duress instruction is most prominent issue in this appeal. If the court has any questions of me about the duress instruction or any of the other issues, I'm more than happy to answer them.
Just an interesting side question I'd like answered. What would Rodriguez receive by way of a sentence in this case?
He hasn't been sentenced yet. He's continuing to cooperate with the government, and there's another trial, in fact, next week.
Is this sentence of 20-plus years based on the amount seized at the apartment?
No, it isn't, Your Honor. It's the amount of drugs that Terry Sawyer dealt during the year or more that she was involved in methamphetamine trafficking. She was a level 38 based on the weight of the drugs, and in fact, this kind of cuts into the sentencing issue. The district court obviously didn't believe her testimony and said so in sentencing her and deciding what point in the guidelines range to sentence her. But the district court did not impose a two-level enhancement for obstruction of justice. The sentence that she got was in the middle of the guidelines range, but it actually could have been a higher sentence. I think the district court felt that the sentence she got was enough and wanted to more or less stay true to the guidelines in the case. But it was weight-driven.
Yeah, your view is the judge discounted her view that her boyfriend, was it Beauchamp, was the principal initial dealer.
Absolutely, and he said so at the sentencing hearing. And you know, the other thing I wanted to make clear is we're in no way conceding that Terry Sawyer was at any time threatened by Seferino Rodriguez. Mr. Rodriguez's testimony was that Terry Sawyer approached him to get methamphetamine and that he never threatened her. And I asked all of the other government witnesses who testified, did Terry Sawyer ever tell you that she was threatened by Seferino Rodriguez? And she said no. But I do think when we're looking at the propriety of the district court's decision to deny the duress instruction, we have to give weight to her testimony to see if it's met the required threshold. The district court just can't say, well, you know, she's made, offered enough evidence, but we don't believe it. That's a question for the jury, and that's why I didn't raise that earlier in my argument. But we don't concede that she was, in fact, threatened.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Cleary?
Your Honor, in regard to the Heather Crowder phone call, I believe it's part of the government's brief, and we would deny that that Ms. Sawyer indicated in there any willingness to continue to deal methamphetamine. And in fact, the trial testimony was that in the days and weeks after that phone call was placed, the government tried to other consensual phone calls that were never even answered by Ms. Sawyer. And the amount of meth found in the search of her house was quite minuscule. I mean, it was a very small amount. It did nothing that would be indicative of ongoing dealing. So with those factual issues, unless the court has other questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Cleary, and we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been to both your client and the court. The case is taken under advisement. And